You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, you may have heard the old saying, you are what you eat. The idea is that what you consume affects your life. The author of a new book says we should apply the same principle to media consumption, as in we are what we watch. We might think of movies and TV as entertainment that's fun at best, mind-numbing at worst. But our guest says data analysis can make the case that pop culture matters and has meaningful impacts on the world around us, from the way our eyes perceive images, the way countries gain soft power on the global stage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has a movie or TV show or maybe novel ever influenced a big decision in your life? Like what kind of pet to adopt, what to study in school, what job to take, where to travel? Is there a piece of pop culture that's really stuck with you over the years? Have you ever changed your mind about something because of a fictional story you watched or read? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Walt Hickey is the senior editor for data at Business Insider and the creator of NumLock News, a daily stat-based newsletter. His new book is called You Are What You Watch, How Movies and TV Affect Everything. Walt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You start your book with your own origin story. You saw Jurassic Park at an early age. A lot of kids might watch that and think, I want to study dinosaurs, or maybe I want to get into genetics. It steered you, but not in those directions.
No, yeah. I watched that film and you know, at the time I was pretty decent at math, but you know, the cultural presentation of people who were good at math were, you know, Professor Franks on The Simpsons and just kind of lab coats and whatnot, crazy men with chalkboards in deep basements. And then you see this swashbuckling, lithe Ian Malcolm, played by Jeff Goldblum, come on, and he's the only guy who's right about Jurassic Park. He's the only one who can kind of predict that coming. And he just expresses his like contentions and his beliefs in just such a like fact-based and exciting manner that is just such a cool representation of what something can be, someone can be, if they kind of follow the stats and follow the numbers. And that got me back interested in maybe this is an actual profession and a career that I can study in college. So,
and
yeah.
That's just one small example of the main point in your book. We might think about, you know, TV and movie entertainment as entertainment. We passively watch it. It goes away. You make the case in the book. Tell us a little bit about it. Why should we take more seriously what we watch?
Yeah. So this book came about because I had been writing about pop culture for a few years, and there was just a recurring idea. I would talk to somebody who either made movies or worked in movies or, you know, was a researcher or a scientist or a doctor. And just kind of off the cuff, they would volunteer like, oh yeah, you know, I used to watch a ton of Grey's Anatomy as a kid, or I used to read a lot of this stuff, or I used to watch The X-Files all the time. And it showed them a different way of kind of seeing their world and potentially motivated them to pursue something that they might have not otherwise pursued. And so I was kind of propelled to just look into, I was wondering how pop culture affected people and how, you know, manifested in the real world. And I just found an ocean of information. I found, you know, it can come down to pets, right? After 101 Dalmatians comes out, all of a sudden Dalmatians become the eighth most popular dog in America overnight when it's re-released in the 90s. You can track name trends. You can track travel trends after The Lord of the Rings, which was shot in New Zealand, gets released around the world. All of a sudden, tourism from the Northern Hemisphere explodes, and you see a huge influx of people traveling halfway across the world to a country that they never would have traveled to before. You just see it time and time again in every different kind of field, from science to government to international relations to, you know, all sorts of different ways that people have been, you know, genuinely affected or genuinely moved in their beliefs, in how they see the world, in how they kind of perceive the world around them. And so that's what the book's about. It just kind of gets to the core of how these things affect us and how the time that we spend, you know, what we might think frivolously just watching things actually has a great deal of meaning and can make a big difference in our lives.
And you write, and I've definitely seen this out there a lot, when people do take a close look at how movies, TV, pop culture influences, it's bad, right? There's a lot of focus on this is influencing our behavior in a bad way, or it's making us lazy, or it's making us violent, or something like that. You dig a lot deeper than that. You find it's not always bad. Why not?
No, yeah, it's quite good. I mean, I think that there's this perception that, when we talk about media consumption, we talk about, television will watch your brain, won't rot your brain. Won't somebody please think of the children? And that tends to be the framework in which we discuss media consumption. And it's wrong. It's not all bad. In fact, it's often pretty dang good. You can see time and time again that, Roger Ebert, the famous film critic, had this belief in this quote that movies are empathy machines, that they give you a chance to kind of take a ride behind the eyes of someone else in the world and develop an understanding perhaps of someone whose life experience you could never have or never maybe be exposed to given your current environment. And that is a kind of a humbling thing. It can make you have a lot more admiration for the people around you, from people who are different than you. And it can give you a better understanding just of how the world works. Time and again, we can see all sorts of different positive impacts when it comes to, people's interest and support for the sciences, right? How you can see people be motivated to do things that they might not have otherwise done. One of my favorite examples from very early in the book, one of the first studies I came across that kind of convinced me that this was a really cool thing to dive into was USA Archery. essentially had to run a study because they were so curious because they saw an influx in members, particularly young people, in the late 2000s and the early 2010s. And they were just like, well, what's happening here? Why are we seeing so many people take up archery as a sport? And so they commissioned a survey and they found that a lot of these people, particularly a lot of the young women, were citing people like Katniss Everdeen and Princess Merida from Brave, even folks like Hawkeye from the Avengers, as this is the thing that got kids interested in doing a sport that, traditionally maybe didn't have a ton of women doing it or traditionally didn't appeal to the broad variety of folks who all of a sudden were compelled to join it. You've seen this effect all sorts of times. One of the original studies that looked into this was the Scully effect from the 90s when the X-Files came out. The presence of Scully on that show, who's a woman who approached things with a great deal of science and sought to solve these crimes and solve these issues from a very STEM perspective, motivated a lot of people to pursue STEM as a career who were women who ordinarily might not have been dissuaded from going there. So you can see movies just and television in particular, and books absolutely as well, really open up people to new potential experiences and oftentimes significantly for the better.
Talking to Walt Hickey, author of the new book, You Are What You Watch, How Movies and TV Affect Everything. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you've had an experience where a movie or a TV show affected something in your life in the short term or maybe a decision you made down the road. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Walt, something I found really fascinating is people have studied physiological changes while we're watching movies. And one example that really stood out, our blood when we're watching a scary movie. What is going on?
Yeah, I love this study. One of the ideas in the book is that this stuff has an effect on you. And if we want to make that contention, I wanted to argue these are not just things that you're seeing. They're things that you're feeling and that your body is reacting to in a manner that your body would react to any other kind of stimulus, right? And so there's all sorts of different ways that we can measure that your nervous system takes films seriously, that when you watch these things, you're not just going on a visual journey. You're not just seeing a spectacle. Your body is actually taking it very seriously. And you as a person are internalizing the things that you're seeing and experiencing. And so one of my favorite studies that really just so illustrates this point is there's this group of researchers. They're actually medical researchers. They study thrombosis. And thrombosis is essentially clotting. It is it's the medical term for, when people suffer a stroke, when they have coagulation where they necessarily shouldn't. That's called thrombosis. In the other direction, you have folks who suffer from hemophilia, which is where they can't, form a scab. And so if an injury could be a very serious matter for them. And all of these come down to the clotting system. And so these researchers who work in the Netherlands are very interested in essentially understanding the human system that oversees clotting. It's one of our most ancient systems. The moment that animals developed blood vessels, we had to start developing the ability to patch those up. So it's a very cool thing. It's a very deep thing. It's a very ancient thing. And to that effect, they were one time, you know, on a little bit of a winter break, and they were, you know, chatting amongst themselves. And because this is Europe, they tend to be polyglot and they speak a lot of languages. And so all these postdocs were talking about the fact that there's a word for blood curdling in all of their languages. They have it in German, they have it in French, they had it in Latin, English. Blood curdling just keeps on coming up. And so being the blood researchers that they are, they were like, well, we ought to look into that, don't you think? And so they essentially they ran a study where they showed people different kinds of movies. Some of them were, you know, calm, low-key, champagne-themed documentaries, just a nice little hour and a half to spend watching how grapes grow. And then the other one was a jump scare full horror movie. And they basically measured the participants' blood before and after each of these. And being the researchers that they are, they discerned that when you see a horror movie, your body releases a chemical that's called a coagulation factor, that is essentially one of the first steps that your body takes when it thinks that it's going to bleed. When your body's preparing itself for a potential injury, or when, you know, it believes that an injury is forthcoming or possible, or just, you know, wants to prime itself for the need to essentially like stop a wound. This is one of the chemicals that is released in higher amounts. And so that conclusion is really exciting because it means that a horror movie is not just a thing that you see, and it's not just a thing that you, you know, watch very passively. It's a thing that your brain takes very seriously, that your brain is preparing for the potential that the things that are scary and frightening on screen could very well injure you, your human body. And even if you know that it's a movie, you're still taking it so seriously that you're having a physical manifestation of that anxiety and of that fear. And I just think that's the coolest thing. I think that it shows that movies are very cool technology that aren't just visual, aren't just audio. They're a piece of tech that can effectively allow our bodies to feel the same things across different people, across different eras, across different areas, you know?
Talking to Walt Hickey, data journalist at Business Insider, looking at his new book, You Are What You Watch, How Movies and TV Affect Everything. In the book, he explains how pop culture has a measurable effect on us individually and collectively, from biology, as we just heard, and personal beliefs, to economics and geopolitics. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever been totally immersed in a movie or TV episode, found you were holding your breath, leaning forward, getting goosebumps? Did you feel that blood curdling that we were just talking about? Or has a piece of pop culture ever made you more hopeful, more cynical, changed your outlook on the world in another way, maybe gave you that baby name you'd been looking for? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with data journalist and author Walt Hickey. His new book is You Are What You Watch, How Movies and TV Affect Everything. It makes the case that pop culture has a lot more power than we may think to shape our lives and our society. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest. What kind of influence has pop culture had in your own life? Maybe in a choice of a career, choice of a name for a kid. How do you feel when you watch that intense movie or TV show? Do you feel that biology we were talking about a couple minutes ago? Join in at 800-642-1234. Here's a movie, a 1978's Animal House, a scene that helped change the way people behaved on college campuses. Here's a listen.
You guys up for a toga party?
Toga! Toga!
I think they like the idea, Hoove.
Oh, Otter, please don't do this.
I got news for you, pal. They're gonna nail us no matter what we do.
So we might as well have a good time.
Toga, 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 toga,
toga. So in 1977, it sounds like, Walt, people at fraternities were not having toga parties. Can you talk a little bit about that story of life or art imitating life, imitating art?
Yeah, it's actually a really cool moment in the history of not just, you know, pop culture, but also, you know, higher education, right? So from the mid-60s to the mid-70s, the number of college students who were the first in their family to go to college hit a very high level. I believe it was just south of 10 million. And it essentially changed a lot of the culture, because, you know, you had people who perhaps had parents or a father who went to college, but then, you know, you had a very large percentage of people who, you know, outnumbering those people who understood how college, you know, ordinarily worked, and just kind of came at it as a new experience and didn't really have a ton of expectations. So when the film Animal House comes out, it's a hit. It's a massive hit. And it helps people define what they want out of a unique college experience. It's based on, you know, the early college experience of a lot of the writers and performers within it. And so, you know, toga parties had existed as a, you know, a post-war fun thing. It's you know, a silly little, you know, thing that someone might do at a university or something. But after it's featured in this film as, oh, you got to have a toga party. then all of a sudden, this shoots up. We were able to kind of track this over time based on, you know, Google's got this system called Ngrams that essentially tracks the usage of words within the English language over time. And we can literally track the increase in the prevalence of toga parties, starting with the release of Animal House. And then in particular, the cool thing about that is that it is kind of this generational thing where the first generation that grew up watching Animal House, they all had toga parties. And then when their kids start going to school in the late 2000s, 2010s, all of a sudden they're like, oh yeah, no, you got to go have a toga party. So you can just kind of see how a pop culture phenomenon was able to insert a tradition essentially into the American higher educational experience and just kind of, you know, find a group of people who, you know, didn't have that vocabulary of what college ought to be, and then essentially provide that for them and to really great effect, to the point that, you know, a lot of bed sheets have been ruined as a result of these events over the course of the past couple decades.
We got an email from Maya who said they named their son Steel after a character in the Dragonlance books. Their daughter's middle name is Ariel after the Little Mermaid. Their truck was named Lucille after The Walking Dead. You chart the influence of pop culture on what we name our kids. It can be big, Walt.
I do. And Ariel comes up. Ariel became extremely popular in the ensuing 10 years after the film The Little Mermaid was released. You know, it's just such a cool, like, instant reverberation, because you can see a television or a show or a book or often a movie really just means something so much to someone that they want to name their kid after a hero or heroine from within it. You know, Ariel was a really big one. Another recent one that we had was Arya. Game of Thrones really put Arya on the map. It was really not a name before George R.R. Martin came up with it. Even the Aryas before then were mostly Aryas, probably named after the book and not just kind of floating around in the general world. But you can see a whole bunch of names. One of my favorite ones, again, we recently lost Matthew Perry, but Chandler became a rather popular name after the premiere of Friends in 1994. You saw a similar effect with Emma, which is essentially the daughter of Ross and Rachel, and who was revealed during that, I believe, Super Bowl episode. Names like Luna from the Harry Potter franchise have really just begun trucking and have reached really high levels over the course of it. And so it's just kind of nice because, again, like, you know, it's really something to make a piece of work that resonates with someone, but it's something else to make something that resonates so substantially that it will, like, you know, somebody's grandma is going to be named Ariel one day. And we are living in that world.
Talking to Walt Hickey about his new book, You Are What You Watch, How Movies and TV Affect Everything. Now, here's one I found interesting, and I've definitely encountered it in interviews on this show. How we perceive crime in our world and how it may be driven more by what we see in pop culture than, you know, what's actually happening with crime statistics. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, certainly. So Gallup is a pollster. I think many people are probably familiar with them. They're really cool because they've existed for a very long time. They were one of the kind of key innovators in the science of polling. And as a result, they have data going back decades. This is really cool for our purposes because they've been running a survey for the past several decades, essentially asking Americans, do you think that crime in your neighborhood is up or down or about the same as it was last year? And what we find is just consistently, year after year, Americans always think that crime is up. They always, by a significant majority, every single year, Americans think that in their neighborhood, crime is up. We know based on crime statistics, crime is not always up. You know, since the late 80s in particular, due to any number of combination of public health gains, any number of changes in policing styles. We can quibble about where exactly it came from, but nevertheless, the reality is crime's down by a lot. And crime went down pretty much year over year for most of the past 40 years. And so as a result, the perception every year that crime is up is usually wrong. Now, don't get me wrong. There are years in which crime goes up. That is absolutely the case. There's been, I think, if I have to recall it off the top of my head, 4 or 5 years over the past 40 where crime has gone up year over year since we started logging these very significant declines. But as a result, you know, there's still going to be a 6 o'clock news every night, and they're going to have to fill 30 minutes. And some of those minutes are going to be crime every night. It's the kind of thing where you can consistently see, you know, if you see shows like Law and Order in New York, I happen to live in New York City. And if you were to watch Law and Order or Law and Order SVU, you know, you would have a very significant idea about the amount of crime that takes place in New York City. It's remaining rather stagnant, enough to fill 23 episodes every year for the past 20 years. But in reality, you know, that's not the case in the slightest. And so we have this kind of perception that perhaps as we get more and more of these, you know, these whodunit shows week after week, or after we watch the news every night with kind of the same block reserved for whatever the biggest crime of the day is, that there's just kind of this distinction between how people actually experience crime in our world with how we perceive crime to be. And so, you know, the statistics can be a little bit comforting on that front, but yeah, the polling is pretty unmistakable. The crime's gone up every year, according to the polls, even if it hasn't necessarily done that in the actual stats.
Just a half a minute left or so. Walt, has doing this project and all this data changed the way you watch TV and movies?
And it totally has in a couple ways. And I like, this isn't a self-help book, but I do have some things that I've actually made me improve how I like media. One is that there's some really cool science in the book that I write about that basically argues that binge watching is not a good way to enjoy things. You know, but that they find that taking breaks in between watching shows, whether those are commercial breaks or breaks between shows, it actually enhances your overall enjoyment of a given show. And so whenever I've, you know, kicked back on a Saturday and watched 5 hours of television, now I actually alternate between shows to just so that I can get a little break in there. And I've actually found that I'm enjoying things a little bit more. I don't know. I don't really come away with it saying that, you know, different kinds of media are good or bad, but I'm definitely aware of what I'm watching more. Definitely trying to broaden my horizons a bit more. Because I just, you know, it's always a good reminder that there's a really big world out there.
That's where we'll leave it. Thanks to our guest, Walt Hickey. We've been talking about his new book, You Are What You Watch, How Movies and TV Affect Everything. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. Say you're in the mood for some hearty soup for dinner tonight. You hop onto Google or whatever search engine and type in potato soup recipe. Next, you're faced with a whopping 350 plus million search results. Now, of course, not all of those are actual recipes, but even if a million of them are, or 100,000, or just 1,000, that's too many for you to wade through. Chances are you look at the first page of results. Google usually highlights about 15. Pick something based on a high user rating or if there's bacon in the picture. The soup could turn out pretty good or it could end up being kind of meh. And you'll wonder why didn't pick one of those other millions of results. Today on Food Friday, a food writer and recipe tester is letting us in on her secrets to finding the best recipes online and why it's so hard to do that sometimes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your tricks for finding great recipes online? Do you have a go-to food website or blog that you start with to look for recipes? What is the best, what's the worst recipe you've ever found online? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Peggy Paul Casella is a professional recipe tester and cookbook author and editor based in Philadelphia. She's the creator of the recipe website, ThursdayNightPizza.com. Peggy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, sometimes we assume when that search engine puts some results on the top, well, they're going to be the best results, right? But you know, and I think we all know that isn't always the case with recipes. Why does that happen?
Mostly because of SEO and because of the way bloggers like me have to make a living. So we kind of all have to go by this very specific rubric that is dictated mostly by Google. And Google means well. The whole point is for Google to sort out which recipes are the best and which blog posts create content that actually will help the person who's looking for that content. But the problem is that within that SEO world, it becomes very formulaic, and bloggers end up playing this endless game of, like, you know, who can take the most beautiful photo? Now, they can take a great photo, but can they really cook? Is that recipe really going to work? So you'll find in the top 5 to 10 search results, a lot of times the photos look the same. Sometimes the people look the same. The format of the blog posts are exactly the same a lot of the time. And that's why.
So SEO, search engine optimization. So you wrote about this in Wired. Sometimes it's a game of chase where Google wants it to look this way. Okay, so if I want to do a blog, I better make it look this way. And there's just this convergence that it all ends up looking kind of the same.
Yeah, yeah. And so on the one hand, Google's done a great service by incentivizing bloggers and food content people to think a lot about the type of content they're putting out there and to, you know, work around this algorithm that we all depend on to get the ad revenue that we're all hoping for every month. So on the one hand, I'm not totally anti-Google here. I think it does challenge people to create that content, to take those process photos for a new recipe they're making and really take a shot of the food that really shows the food, you know, and be mindful about the tips and tricks you're putting in your post. But I do think a lot of content creators take all the shortcuts they can take just to pad those posts with keywords and things that they know Google wants without actually making the recipe, without actually testing the recipe.
Okay, so we have found that recipe online, or we're looking for a recipe for a particular dish. What do we do to glance at that recipe and say, okay, this looks like the real deal. This looks like kind of a half-baked attempt to get that search engine optimization. How do we evaluate a recipe to see, yeah, this one's the real deal?
Okay, so I would say usually when I'm looking for a recipe, one of the first things I do is I hit that little button at the top of the recipe or atop of the blog post that says skip to recipe. I skip to the recipe and then I look at it. Does it have ratings? If so, I skim the comments a bit to see, okay, how mindful are these comments? Are these all people the person knows that have been, like, you know, mindlessly just giving them a 5-star rating? Or are there comments from loyal cooks who come back to that recipe and take the time to write a paragraph about how it worked? And if that's the case, then you know it works. So that's one way that you can absolutely tell. Another way is if you look at the photographs that the blogger or food content creator has put up, are there process shots? Because if there's process shots, at least you have a better chance of believing that that person actually made the recipe. Another way is in the recipe itself. Are the steps specific? You know, one example I always bring up when I'm talking to other people in this world are, you know, onions drive me crazy. So if you're reading an article, or I'm sorry, if you're reading a recipe and you see someone has said 1 cup of onions, you're like, wait a minute.
That's one whole onion. Sure.
Right. Do you cram a whole onion in a cup measure? No. No one's ever going to think that. I know. But on the other hand, it just shows that the cook, the content creator, was not very mindful to give the reader, all right, well, okay, it's just chopped. Is it minced? Mm-hmm. Is it shredded? Is it sliced? You know, those are very different measurements. So that's the kind of thing I look for. Like, how mindful is the recipe? And also, do they have loyal test cooks who are writing comments about how it turned out or maybe how they tweaked it a little bit? I think those are my main tips, at least.
Talking to Peggy Paul Casella, professional recipe tester, cookbook author. She's the creator of the recipe website, ThursdayNightPizza.com. On this edition of Food Friday, she is helping us find good recipes on the internet and figure out how to know what could be a good recipe. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you found recipe websites that you go back to again and again because they work, they're reliable? Have you had food disasters based on cooking something off the internet? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. So, Peggy, the recipe I've used the most that I found online is a zucchini relish recipe. Zucchini disposal is a big issue here. It's from like 2011. The website looks like it could have been made in the 1990s. I try to search for that recipe by name. It does not come up on search engines. I have to keep the link so I can keep finding the recipe if I want to share it with other people. Like, I don't know, sometimes those older ones were a labor of love. They weren't worried about bringing in the audience. Do you have thoughts on finding those out of the way, off the beaten path recipes?
I sure do. One of the things, there are a few recipes, right? When you're looking for a zucchini bread recipe, for instance, if you're me, right? And you grew up eating mom's zucchini bread and you don't want a newfangled version. You want the kind that you had when you were 12. For those types of recipes, I actually do. I try not to go with one of the latest blogs or recipe websites out there. I go searching. I call it spelunking through the internet. I will search it three different ways. I'll try and remember, like, what was one ingredient that was in there that might not be in these newer versions? Like, you know, I want a zucchini bread that uses vegetable oil. You know, clutch your pearls, right? I want a zucchini recipe that uses cinnamon and vegetable oil. Now that search result will come up with, yes, the typical results at the top. And some of those may be awesome. But if you're looking for more, an older school, less frills, go like five pages into the search results and then look there. And then keep looking, or maybe even search something crazy like zucchini bread recipe, like the Fanny Farmer cookbook, you know, something like that might draw up a more interesting result.
We're going to get a link, by the way, to that very specific zucchini relish recipe at WPR.org/Central Time if people want to make it at home, if you've got those big zucchini left over. Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Carolyn is with us in Oconomowoc. Carolyn, hi.
Hi. So my experience, I think I was following a recipe from maybe BuzzFeed. It was for, I want to say, like, ultimate chocolate chip cookies, and they recommended using browned butter instead of regular butter. And in the recipe, it said, oh, as you brown your butter, it's going to reduce in volume. So if you're not at quite 2 cups or whatever, once you brown the butter, just add a little bit of extra water into the measuring cup. If you add cold water to hot brown butter, it will explode. And is real hard to clean up all that butter.
You're okay,
recipe.
I hope, Carolyn, right? You're fine?
I'm okay. I'm fine, but that measuring cup has never looked the same.
Wow. Carolyn, thanks for that call. Yeah, that are there red flags for you, Peggy, where this is clearly something untested because it just defies the laws of physics?
Totally. All the time. There are things, I can't think of an example right now, of course. I can't think of a good one, but mostly, I find it a lot in measurements, like I said, with the onions. I also find it a lot with times. Like, there have been a few times that I've had to laugh out loud where I've seen, you know, someone writing a recipe for caramelizing onions, but they only are using half an onion and they're using a giant Dutch oven. And if you just do some simple critical thinking, you think, all right, well, if that surface area is only for this little bit of onion, and you're saying to cook it for an hour, well, those onions are not going to be good, honey.
Carbonized, not caramelized, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and that's just one example that I think I'm mushing together a few different things I've seen. But Yeah, it's just that kind of thing. And then a lot of times you'll find a recipe that clearly is not using enough liquid or sometimes too much liquid based on the type of pan they're asking for. I've seen a recipe for a gravy that was making enough gravy for like a Thanksgiving turkey for, you know, 20 people. And it said, make the gravy, take out your smallest saucepan. And I'm like, I don't think that's going to work.
A dot of gravy on each serving. We're talking to Peggy Paul Casella, professional recipe tester, cookbook author and editor, creator of the recipe website, ThursdayNightPizza.com. She's with us on Food Friday to let us in on the secrets of how to sift through thousands, millions of search results and find good, usable recipes online. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a go-to fantastic recipe that you found online? You can tell us about it. Maybe it was in an unexpected place on the internet. How about a recipe that looked great in the photos but turned out to be a dud or exploded even? Tell us about it. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're picking up our talk with food writer and recipe tester Peggy Paul Casella about how to find good recipes on the internet and how to figure out which ones are good and which ones are eh. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a go-to recipe source online for you? What do you do when you're searching for, you know, I want to make blank or I have this ingredient? Do you have a method that gives you pretty good results? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234 with your questions or stories. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. James on Facebook says Chef John's Food Wishes channel on YouTube is a great source for new recipes to try. I love his plussed up take on franken beans. Okay. YouTube videos, Peggy, how useful do you find those when it comes to recipes? I tend not to like them unless it's a very specific technique. I just want to read the thing. Do you see a role for videos?
I sure do. I think, one, as a content creator myself, who is chained to the Google algorithm, I got into doing video because that was what was preferred. And it was a recommendation brought to me a million times by a million different sources for growth. So I started doing video and I found at first I was hesitant. Then as I did it myself, I started looking on YouTube at what is out there more. And I gotta say, I mean, there are some videos where I think, man, you know, that didn't have to be a video. You could have just written that down. Because I think, you know, I'm not one that just likes to put my face on a screen just to put my face on a screen, but other videos, as a recipe tester, there are a lot of times where I will be working. This just happened. I was editing, an Italian cookbook and the author was trying to explain how to fillet anchovies, fresh anchovies. And I have never filleted a fresh anchovy myself. And so I was reading the description. I was confused by it in the book. And I thought, all right, I know what to do. I'm going to go to YouTube. I'm going to find someone who's filleting an anchovy. And then I'm going to help this author rewrite the description in a way that's more visual. And it, like, those things I go to a lot. I found this adorable old, like, you know, she was probably like an 80-year-old Italian grandmother filleting an anchovy. And it just, she did it so well on this video. And I just thought, yeah, I mean, that's why YouTube is there for cooking. I think I'm the same. I love a written recipe, but I've really come around to the video recipe.
You mentioned cutting up an anchovy. I've used YouTube for, you know, cutting up the best way to cut up a pineapple or whatever, that specific kind of technique thing. I totally get that. Now, I'm thinking with your pizza website, an example comes to mind here. Just the challenge of, okay, I know how to do this. How do I convey it to others? Years ago, a friend of mine, an amazing cook, was talking me through making my own pizza dough. And he was like, knead it until it feels right. was his instruction to me. It did not come out well. How do you take that sort of like thing that you just know, right, and then figure out a way to tell me, Rob, how to do it so I know what feels right means?
You know, I just try and be as honest as possible. I used to teach more pizza classes here in Philadelphia. And when I did that, I would get the best questions as I'm making the dough. And that really helped me understand what I understand may not be what someone else understands. So now when I'm doing a video, I try and do, you know, I try and make it really clear what step is what, and I try and like kind of slow down and show each thing at the different steps, because, you know, I've made mistakes in the past where I've put up a recipe and not described it as well. And then I get a flourish of comments saying, this recipe doesn't work. It's, you know, it's too this or it's too that. And then I go back and read those comments. And at first, you know, I'm a little salty about it, but then I read them again. And then I realize, oh, shoot, I should have explained that you need it until you press on it and it comes back a little bit, or until, or you knead it with your hands like a cat kneading a sweater, you know? So yeah, it's tough. It is tough, but I try and listen to the comments when they come in, and I try and workshop it, and I'll sometimes run a description by my sister or my husband, or even my six-year-old son, you know, like, would you understand this?
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Gary is with us in Brookfield. Gary, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. The one thought I had is you keep talking about using Google as a search engine, and 1A had a really good program on that a couple of weeks ago where they talked about how Google has changed over the last 15, 20 years. And, you know, perhaps using a different search engine such as DuckDuckGo would be beneficial.
Oh, Gary, interesting point. Peggy, have you tried comparing and contrasting different search engines when searching for recipes online?
That is a great point. You know, Google is usually my standard go-to because they're the gold standard of how I make my living. You know, like I get ad revenue and a lot of that is based on the Google algorithm and, you know, how many people are clicking on ads through Google on my site. So that's why I favor that. But yes, I have looked on Bing before to compare, especially when I was writing this article for Wired. The search results are different. It's, in my experience, it wasn't as different as I expected it to be, but it is different. And that is another way to kind of expose other recipe websites that maybe you wouldn't find otherwise.
All right. Thanks for that call, Gary. I just tried on DuckDuckGo looking for that zucchini relish. Again, not seeing the result, except I'm seeing WPR.org from the last time we linked it, actually. Okay. Peggy, you were starting to touch on this earlier. For that focused search, you gave an example in the Wired article about, I think it was spanakopita, like trying to find the recipe that's going to meet your needs best.
Yeah, it's kind of how we have to do anything now, right? I mean, the world we're in, information is out there and that's great, but there's so much information that you really have to learn how to sort for it. I mean, I draw a parallel between sitting down on a Friday night trying to watch something on TV through the many different streaming services we have now. How do you pick a show to watch? It's kind of similar, you know? So yeah, I mean, if you're looking for a mac and cheese recipe, this is a great example, actually. Mac and cheese is a fantastic idea. So if you are looking for mac and cheese, right? We all know it's not that simple. Do you want a creamy stovetop mac and cheese, or are you more of a baked mac and cheese person that likes it a little more dry? I think if you can describe what you want from the result in your search engine, then you're way more likely to end up with something that you're really looking for.
We'll leave it there. Peggy, thanks again for joining us today. Been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Peggy Paul Casella, professional recipe tester, cookbook author and editor, creator of the recipe website ThursdayNightPizza.com. She joined us on Food Friday for a look at finding good recipes online. You could keep sharing your favorite sources for great online recipes or successes or failures, explosive or otherwise, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. People have probably been giving advice, solicited and unsolicited, for as long as there have been people. But as far as we know, the first official advice giving happened over 300 years ago in a British magazine called the Athenian Mercury. In the hundreds of years since, advice columns have thrived, as they likely will for as long as humans have advice to give and a place to publish that advice. Our next guest is a big name in the advice column world and joins us for a behind-the-scenes look, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you read advice columns or listen to advice podcasts? What do you get from them? What's your favorite advice column? Is it the one written by Carolyn Hacks? Have you ever submitted a question to one of them? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Carolyn Hacks has been writing an advice column for the Washington Post for just about three decades now. Carolyn, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I want to get your origin story, Carolyn. How did you become an advice columnist?
By insulting advice columns. I was working for an editor. I was already at the Washington Post as a news editor, and I was working with another editor who was thinking about taking on a new advice column for younger readers under some pressure from her bosses. And so I heard the names that she was considering and I gave my reviews. And I didn't. And I said, what you really need is a snotty 30-year-old writing one of these things. And lo and behold, I was 30 and had some snark problems. And I had a column probably within 3 to 5 weeks. I can't remember exactly the turnaround time, but it was pretty quick.
Now, you've evolved the column. It's now not just for younger readers and advice seekers, but were there unique things for, say, I guess it'd be Gen X readers at the time that you thought you could meet the needs of that they weren't getting from some of the longer running advice columns?
I thought so. Now with a little bit of hindsight, I just think what I had was an attitude. And but at the same time, I think just reading things that weren't to me to my ear weren't in our language was a problem. And I thought that the message wouldn't necessarily get across if it was just a bad fit. And a funny thing is, even with all of the opinionated approaches that I took to what I was doing, I've always believed all along that people are just people. And so I think it was more a matter of what is going to deliver a fairly universal message, but in a targeted or tailored or entertaining way.
Now, people ask you very personal and weighty questions, whether to stay in a marriage, whether to have more kids, how to deal with dysfunctional family dynamics. The list goes on and on. Once you've gotten a question, you've decided this is what you're going to tackle. What's your method? How do you approach it?
Well, I'm just going to stop you for a second. When you list it that way, it sounds impossible. Like, what am I doing? somebody asking me if they should stay in their marriage. Pass. I don't know. but it's funny. Once you get into the mode, once you get into the answering mode, you just sort of you're immersed in it and you believe in it. And I think my method is to approach each question with suggestions for how to think, because I don't think it's necessarily appropriate. I mean, I was just joking about it, but I really don't think it's appropriate for me to say, wow, you got to get out of there. Right. Except in very extreme circumstances, which I do sometimes. But most of the time it's okay. Here's the situation you described to me. Here are the five things I would think about, or here's where I would start this process, or here are the small things that you can do to help you see if you can feel better that way with a very limited reach into your list of changes and see if that helps. You know, so it's very measured, actually. I try to keep the writing I try to keep the writing loose, but the advice is very conservative, actually.
Carolyn Hax is with us. Carolyn's been writing an advice column at the Washington Post for about 30 years, just about. You could join in with your questions about what it's like to be an advice columnist. If you read advice columns, Carolyn's or others, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Stephanie is with us in Madison. Stephanie, hi.
Hi there, Rob, and hi, Carolyn Hax. You are one of my favorite columnists. I just called to basically tell you that when I heard that there was going to be an advice columnist on this show, I called to find out, and I'm like, oh, yay! No, you know, I really like the way you approach problems because, you know, you don't preach to people. You don't put yourself above people. Your advice is very intelligent, you know. You look at things here's the situation. These are things you realistically can control or not control. But you're very thoughtful. And you've described keeping your advice conservative, except in like extreme situations and being, you know, looking at ways of thinking about the problem. And I really appreciate that a lot. I mean, I'm dealing with my own stuff right now, but we always are, you know, no matter what. I'm going to turn 74 at the end of this month, and I've been losing my vision and other things. But, you know, I mean, I personally really look, I find the advice columns, yours, Ask Amy, the Miss Manners, I find them very helpful.
Stephanie, thank you so much. Carolyn, Stephanie, clearly, I imagine a lot of people like this find reading your advice columns, maybe others, helpful, even if it isn't their particular question that day.
I hope so. I mean, first of all, I want to say thank you. That was a lovely comment. I can't ask for a better reader. I really appreciate that. And I also, aside from the kind words, I feel really seen on sort of what I'm trying to get across. And so, and of course, you never know. I'm having a really one-sided conversation here. I'm just sort of banging away at my laptop, and I can't always know that what I intend is going to be received that way. And so to have somebody recognize that I'm not trying to make pronouncements from on high is really lovely to hear. But now it's... Now I've forgotten the question you asked me.
you answered it. I think that people are getting something out of your column, even if it's, you know, even if Stephanie didn't write the question you answered that day. Yeah.
Right. Well, of course, yes. And I did have an answer in mind for that. So that's why I wanted to circle back to it. but I think that when you were asking me earlier about my approach, and one of the things that I try to keep in mind is that there's always a second answer. So there's the primary answer that addresses the narrow topic that somebody has brought up. But to me, there's always a second answer, which associates that narrow issue with its context. And I think when you start bringing things into context and connecting it to other things, that's when you really start to address other people as well. And also, I think you get it more of the issue if you treat it in context instead of in isolation.
Thanks a lot for the call, Stephanie. We'll go to Fawn now in Madison. Fawn, hi.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to say, I'm kind of like the last column. I had to call it. Sorry. Sorry. I just wanted to say, sorry about that. I just wanted to say, oh, no, why just when I got on the line, I started to sneeze.
That's the fear of live radio, that coughing fit, Fawn, but it's okay.
Okay. No, I really appreciate
your column. I have this effect on
people. Oh, dear. No, I really appreciate your column. I like your approach and your fresh tone, your fresh voice, basically, sounds. I guess that's what you were aiming for from the beginning. And that exactly, you do give advice that is really measured, and it seems to me sensible and sensitive at the same time, and you, with a well-rounded, you know, perspective. Rare have been the occasions I've disagreed with you or occasionally I wanted to chime in and say, and this, or have you considered this? And I also like that you seem to crowdsource some of your, or you allow readers to chime in online, I suppose, and then, you know, put their two cents in, some of which you excerpt and publish also.
Fawn, thanks a lot for the call. I wanted to bring that up, Carolyn. There's some call and response there. You give your take, and often you'll share other readers' thoughts for the initial question asker.
Yeah, so that comes from a live online chat that I do. And I don't have anybody reading my answers before I post them. So this is truly live, even though I'm slow. I mean, it's sort of live in a tortoise-like kind of way. But there's no net. There's no you know, delay button to make sure I don't say something horrible. So one of the things that's so, I think, different about this chat is I get to have crowdsource corrections as I go, or my incomplete answer that I throw out there in 2 minutes gets completed by reader feedback. And so when we decided to, the decision to include the adapted columns from these transcripts was part of a decision to go daily. And I said, I didn't want to go daily with all new material plus the chats, because I said, then I would be rushing. I want to be able to take my time. And so we did this combination of the three columns that original each week that I take my time with, and then we adapt the transcripts of the chats. And so I decided to preserve the format of my throwing out a possibly complete but more likely incomplete answer that gets completed by other observations. And I don't know, I enjoy it. I don't know if readers appreciate it. Sometimes I get people saying, like, I'm not reading your column to see what other people have to say. But then I also get criticism sometimes that, oh, you know, you never admit you're wrong. I'm like, I bring in other voices almost every column saying, well, I think that, you know, I think there's this perspective also. So I don't know. I think it rounds out what I'm trying to do. And again, which includes acknowledging that how I look at something is not the be all and end all. We're all different. We all come at the same problem in very different ways. And so having somebody else look at it, I think, adds something.
Fawn, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about advice columns. Our guest is Carolyn Hax, who's been writing an advice column at the Washington Post for pretty near three decades now. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you listen to advice podcasts or read advice columns? Do you ever apply what you hear there to your own life? Have you ever written in a question to Carolyn or other advice columnists? Did you get good advice? Do you go way back with advice columns to where you would read them in a newspaper and maybe write back with your own take on it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about advice columns, their popularity, what we can learn from them with the person who writes one. Carolyn Hax is with us. She writes an advice column at the Washington Post. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for Carolyn about what it's like to write an advice column. If you are a fan of hers or other advice columns, or nowadays podcasts or chats or you name it, love to hear your experience, what you like about it. 800-642-1234. Or if you have an old school favorite, the Dear Abby's or Ann Landers's, join it at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Nick is with us in Beloit. Nick, hi.
Hey, how's it going? I had a weird question about writing for an advice column, which was, do you ever get someone writing in asking you something where you just wonder, why are they asking me this? Who am I to answer this question? And also, I was curious, like, when you have something like that, like, I mean, I know you said that you wrote them more or less live, but is there a certain amount of fear that goes into giving the wrong advice?
Interesting, Nick. Carolyn?
Well, okay, so I'll answer the second one first. I spent a lot of time lying awake at night, especially when I first started doing this, because it is really presumptuous to just take a question that's maybe four paragraphs and say, okay, go do this with your life. I take that very seriously. And I think it's one of the reasons I developed the approach that I have now of just suggesting things for people to think about, because that takes my fingerprints off some things. It gets me out of people's business where I really don't belong. But I think the first part is, it reminds me a little bit of comedy where they say that the way to be funny is to just buy into the bit, just go all in. And I think the advice column is such a bizarre institution. I mean, it is a deeply bizarre institution when you think about it. And if I, you know, for example, I will get people following up with their questions, wondering why I haven't answered it yet. And I'm like, well, you haven't bought into the whole bit. I mean, this is this is a bunch of people basically, I think people are writing into the void. I don't think they realistically expect an answer, most of them. And I think it's just a way of just, it's like throwing coins in a fountain. And so what we're doing is more of a, instead of my speaking to somebody asking me a question, I think it's more of a collective experience of we're gonna throw out these things that I think everybody thinks about a little bit or that I'm really struggling with. And I think I don't necessarily want to talk about with my friends. And so I'm going to throw it out there and see if we can air this public analysis of this issue. And I think that's been borne out in my experience because sometimes when I answer people, they write back and say, oh my gosh, I never expected that this would get answered. And I think that's actually a very normal way of approaching this.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Marcus joins us next in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hey, Rob. So my great uncle Don used to tell me when it comes to advice that I should keep a rake and a broom. And I said, are we doing yard work? He said, no. He said, keep a mental rake and a mental broom. Rake in that which is useful to you and broom the rest. Because it's our own personal responsibility to determine what's right for us. So I think that by providing the advice, people are asking for it, and some might be writing into the void, as you say, but other people might actually, you know, they're actually asking the question, and so, you know, it just provides food for thought, and it's not your responsibility what they, you know, it's their decision that they ultimately make to take the advice or not.
Marcus, thanks
I'm
a lot.
Take
oh, good, Carolyn, yeah.
Okay, that's really useful. I'm going to write that down. I'm going to put it above my desk.
Thanks a lot.
I answered you. Now it's not my problem.
Thanks a lot, Marcus. And that makes me wonder, Carolyn, do you have advice for advice column readers about what to do with your advice or others, how to engage with it in a way that says, okay, yes, I like this. I'm going to question that. I'm going to discard that.
I think you just said it. I think anything we read, though, and I don't think it applies just to advice or my advice or columns or podcasts. I think everything we come across presents us with a filtering challenge. And I think it's a healthy way to approach things where you take what serves you or what is true. Since we want to talk about the broader context, you don't just take the information that serves you best and throw away the rest. I think you look at the big picture for what is correct and what is fair and what is useful and use those pieces. And I think the more that we can gather, the more effectively we can screen and gather the information coming at us, I think the more successful we can be just as people.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Carolyn Hacks is with us. She writes an advice column at the Washington Post talking about advice columns. Carolyn, some things in the old media, whatever you call them, haven't translated well to the internet or have been replaced by a lot of other things. Advice columns. Now, people do go on Reddit and try to crowdsource advice or Quora or whatever. There's a long, long list. But there's clearly still a demand for you and other particular personalities to keep doing this advice column. Why? Why did that that element of our older media stick around and find such appeal online?
I can't say that I know. thank goodness it did. But I think the things that the itches that an advice column satisfies are still there. And I think first of all, I think the advice columns have always been successful based on the voice behind them. And so that's something that, that's something you get with a column, but you don't get with crowdsourcing. Although, again, we go back to the fact that I'm using other people, I'm picking up reader comments. I think actually there are some amazing thinkers and writers out there in my audience. And I love amplifying their voices. So, but I think that adds to what I'm doing, and it doesn't necessarily say, okay, crowdsourcing is a great alternative to a single voice column, because I, again, there's a familiar voice. And if you like the way somebody writes, or if you like the way somebody thinks, it's a familiar and welcoming place. And then the topic is so universal. I guess I'm talking about just being human. It's not, oh, I'm talking about climate or politics or decorating. I mean, this is how we live. This is how we interact with people. And it's endless. The amount of connections we can make to our own lives in one column that might have nothing to do with our lives in particular.
Well, speaking of your voice, we heard from Ritt in Madison who couldn't stay on the line. Ritt says he's loved your columns for a long time, and his kids, Carolyn, his kids coined the phrase, quote, bringing down the hacks. And that refers to saying things with lots of sass. You're a legend now. You are in a phrase in Ritt's family. How do you feel about that?
I wish you'd been able to stay on, because I want to ask him, like, do they hate me?
I get the sense it's very positive. Yeah. I don't know. No, Ritt's a fan, it sounds like. Carolyn, can you leave us in just our last, a little less than a minute now, with a bit of advice when we have that, interpersonal friction in our lives, a starting point to step back and think things through, whether or not we write to an advice column?
Yes. Oh, my God. I think that the happiness is inversely proportional to the number of things you take personally. So if somebody does something awful, if you choose to recognize it as something as their thing and not speaking directly to you, it's very calming. It's just it's a wonderful release. Pure arguments.
It's a great place to leave it. Carolyn, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you again for having me.
That's Carolyn Hacks. Carolyn's been writing an advice column at the Washington Post for a good long time now. She talked with us about how she approaches her work and what we can learn from advice columns. Still time for you to share your favorite advice columns, past or present. Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.